callings can be just for seasons in your life. And I didn't recognize that at the time. And so by continuing to try to make something happen, to try to engineer more opportunities, what it ultimately did was just reveal that it had become an idol.
Welcome to the Habit Podcast, conversations with writers about writing. I'm Jonathan Rogers, your host. Doug Powell is a musician, a songwriter, a designer, a coder, a Christian apologist, and now a fiction writer. He recently published Among the Ashes, the second in his Graham Elliott series of biblical archaeological thrillers. Doug Powell, I am so happy to have you on the Habit Podcast today. Thanks for coming.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
You and I have known each other for a very long time, way more than 20 years. My first job out of college, there you were. And we were both at this technology company that it feels like it wasn't. I mean, I know it wasn't a great fit for my talents and interests. I don't know, maybe it was a little bit more for you, but it did me a lot of good to have a real job, and I learned how to sort of be a grown-up there. But I also remember I think my first bit of interactive software I ever kind of, I feel like the first time I ever experienced interactive software was something you made, some kind of little flash.
Yeah, so that was a multimedia company that ended up focusing on continued medical education training. But we initially had all sorts of stuff that we did. That was the age of CD-ROMs and interactivity and stuff like that. So we worked on whatever we got hired to do.
Yeah, I know. You were like a web designer, but the internet wasn't exactly invented. I mean, it was invented, but it was,
It wasn't robust enough to deliver all the video and stuff and all of that. So we were still making CD-ROMs and sending them out at that point.
Yeah. Well, I mean, your work as a programmer and a designer was some of the first I'd ever, you know, had such a close look at. And so, you know, in some ways you were a big part of my education in that kind of thing. And then things so started funny. Unfolding about all the other things that you do and did and do. And as I was sort of getting ready for this interview, it occurred to me that I'm almost sure you were the first person that ever heard to use the term power pop, because you were a practitioner of power pop. Is that fair to say?
Well, that's how I got labeled when I did my music career. It was labeled as power pop, for like lack of a better term, which then became like a thing after I got out of it. So a little bit of a man out of time.
It became a thing, yeah.
So during the 90s, when I had my record deals and was working in that business, my music was very melodically centered, and that was labeled as power pop. And in the middle of a grunge world, that didn't go over very good, which explains why I ended up getting a day job with you.
Yeah. Well, you had a little record called Curiouser that was played in my house all the time. My kids and I too were crazy about that record.
Oh, thanks.
And so, and also, you introduced me to the name Brian Eno. I'd never heard that word before, but that's a very helpful name to know when you do crossword puzzles.
Brian Eno, he is a good one. There's not a lot of guys named Eno out there, so he's a good three-letter word.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. And of course, then you got into the apologetics business. What, like 8 or 10 apologetics books you've done?
Is that true? It's a few more than that.
Okay.
But you know, not all of them are of equal length or anything.
Yeah, right,
some of them are smaller, more booklet size. But yeah, there's that's one of the other things that I got into. I think that's one of the things that one of the ways we got to know each other is just overhearing conversations in the break room or whatever. And we realized, I think, that we were both part of the PCA at that point.
Yeah, right.
And started going out to lunch and hanging out. And it's not just me who had these hidden lives, but it was you, because that's when you got your novel deal and quit your job and went off into that world.
Yeah, and of course now you're in the novel writing business too. You're the only person I know who writes biblical archaeological thrillers. So
it's a niche genre for sure.
Yeah, the Graham Elliott books. So you're in the middle of, you recently published the second of three of these in this series.
There are three that are currently done. The third one's in the last stage of revision right now, and it'll be out in October. Mm-hmm. A fourth one is done.
Okay.
And turned in, and then I'm in the middle of plotting out the book five right now.
Oh, okay. I didn't understand there were that many in the series.
There's lots of archaeology out there.
Yeah, right.
There's lots of stuff for Graham to go do. So as long as I could think up new stuff for him to do, because that's way easier than coming up with a whole new set of characters.
Yeah, right.
Because, you know, there's... I was not a fiction writer growing up, never did short stories, anything like that. Mm-hmm. Always admired it. I absolutely devour novels, but I didn't, I thought it'd be cool to somehow find the switch that turns on novel writing, but I didn't know how to go about it or anything like that. So,
how did you get that switch flipped?
For that switch to finally get turned on, another one had to get turned off, and that's music. Uh-huh. So music, which was the central part of everything I did with my talents and interests, mm-hmm. for most of my life, finally ran out of steam. And there was, you know, my understanding, that was kind of a hard stop for me, because that was something that I had so much of my identity invested in, that when the opportunity ran out for me to do it, I still had a passion for it and an interest in doing it. And I banged my head against doors trying to make those opportunities. And At that point, I just didn't have an understanding of calling that that included that callings can be just for seasons in your mm-hmm. life, and I didn't recognize that at the time. And so by continuing to try to make something happen, to try to engineer more opportunities, what it ultimately did was just reveal that it had become an idol. Yeah. And that was something that was pretty devastating. Took me quite a while to figure out how to work through. But at the same time that happened, all of a sudden this unexpected opportunity to write an apologetics book came my way. And so I poured everything into that. And that's where all of my energies went. But it didn't dip from the same creative well. I love writing apologetics books and being helpful and trying to come up with new ways of explaining things. None of my books have any original material in it, mm-hmm. in terms of original research. What it is, I'm really just a popularizer in terms of apologetics. But I had to, so the creative part was like coming up with new ways of saying stuff that other people had already said. Uh-huh. But as a like an originating creative endeavor, that wasn't it. And uh-huh. I was about 8 years ago, 8 or 9 years ago, I got invited to a presentation in Plano, Texas, that was being put on by Josh McDowell. And he invited like 100, 125 people to Plano, Texas. to see a presentation by a guy named Scott Carroll, who had been hired by the Green family, the Hobby Lobby Green family, for 10 years to acquire what eventually became the core of the acquisitions of the Museum of the Bible. And he had just finished that time with them, and he was, Josh McDowell wanted him to demonstrate to a bunch of apologists and scholars one of the ways in which he was recovering or discovering new biblical manuscripts. So what he was doing was he had two mummy masks with him, one that Josh McDowell had him buy and then one that he bought on his own. And they were made of cartonnage. And cartonnage is really just paper mache, except there was no paper back when they were mummifying people. So they would use papyri to do it. And so he explained that when these papyri masks would be made, the funerary attendant would be sent down to like whatever junkyard around whatever town they were in to find old documents or letters or inventories or business things or books that had been discarded and bring them back. And they made this cartonnage, this paper mache out of it. And so he thought, well, if they're just repurposing a bunch of stuff, if you could find a mummy mask from the right time period and in the right location, you might be able to find, you know, discarded fragments from scripture. And so that's what he was doing. He had come up with a proprietary solution that would dissolve whatever adhesive had made this paper mache. He spray fixed the front of the mask so it wouldn't dissolve. And he had an industrial size sink that there was a camera over it. And he put on this headset so he could describe what he was doing. And he took this mummy mask and he sunk it into the into this solution. And he started working the back of it. And a few minutes later, out of the bubbles, he pulled his hand out and there was a piece of papyri. And he said, well, this has Greek text on it or Greek characters and it's Egyptian language. So it's Coptic, maybe third or fourth century. And he set it aside and he just kept going.
And, and you're saying you were watching this as it was going?
I was watching this. We were all watching him do it. He had this big screen set up, but he had explained what he was going to do in the room in front of us. And then he had to go in this industrial pantry of where they had this sink. And so we were all watching him do it, thinking, this is the coolest thing of all time. That was amazing. He just kept pulling things out. And he speaks like, you know, 17, or not speaks, but he reads 17 different ancient languages. And he was pulling all sorts of stuff out and trying to describe it. Some he could read and some he couldn't. Some was totally blackened with age and would have to be read under UV light if you were going to recover anything. And so we took a break and went to lunch after we got it all done. And he let it all dry. And then when we came back, there were like 10 tables set up around with the fragments distributed among them. And there were computers at each table that were all logged into an ancient manuscript database. And we were invited to just go around, visit tables, read as much as we could on each fragment and put in the words that we could read in the order that we could read them into the ancient manuscript database. And it'd be treated like keywords and it would tell you what it was from. And less than half the time, it would actually come up with something. And I am not a Greek scholar. The only word I read all weekend was the Greek word and. Okay, so I wasn't helpful at all. My I wasn't allowed near the ancient manuscript database. But by the end of the weekend, he announced that there had been five fragments from the New Testament that were found written in Coptic, and they were from about the fourth century, if I remember right. And in each case, it was the oldest Coptic copy ever found of that particular passage.
Oh, really?
And so that was like incredible to watch this go down. But I was sitting there with some friends, and we started talking about, well, what's the craziest thing that he could possibly pull out of there? Mm-hmm. You know, and we were actually trying to answer it or even batting back ideas. It was just like a really cool, what would it even be? And about 2 years later, wasn't even trying to think about it, but I, you know, had this, I had to get back to creating something. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what it was going to be. And all of a sudden, this idea of what could have been found in the mummy basket occurred to me. And that became the first scene of the first novel. And it just unfolded. I mean, I love biblical archaeology. It's one of the things that I give talks on and I've written about. And there were things that just suggested themselves. And it kind of turned into this Da Vinci Code-like treasure hunt. Da Vinci Code, you know, I really enjoy the Da Vinci Code. What I don't enjoy is how it was promoted as being factual. Yeah. That was the problem. That was the main fiction of it, actually. But I really enjoyed reading it. So I thought, wouldn't it be cool to like actually write this and have everything in it be real? Everything in it be real. How close can you get to keeping everything real? Well, how little amount of fiction do you have to add to make a story work like this? And so, you know, I love Michael Crichton, and I think that's what he's one of the things he's really good at. And he hides where the fudge is so well that I love like getting to the end and having to read his afterword to figure it out. You know, where did the line get blurred?
Yeah.
And so that's how I ended up writing this book. And by the time I, you know, was plotting it out, I realized that there's no way I could write a book with all that stuff in it. This is more like three books. And so the, you know, where, what was going to happen, happened pretty quick. But, you know, then I discovered that what I had was, I turned out to be, find the plotting of it super fun and actually the easier part of it. What was very difficult for me and where my weakness is the characters. Uh-huh. You know, making people who are real and that somebody will care about. Mm-hmm. And that was the thing that I really have worked on most. Mm-hmm. That's the thing that's least intuitive to me, but that became the only thing that comes even close to creating music for me.
Hmm. Yeah. So you can point to a week or a few day period where something came back to you. Is it a part of a creative energy that had kind of, it was, what's the word? Interrupted, came back.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it was like all stored up and looking for something to shoot at. It was needed to discharge somehow.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what that was going to be. I just knew it wasn't going to be music. It was, you know, I still do, depending on the day, have a little bit of PTSD about the music business. So I wasn't trying to figure out more ways to make music. I needed to find a different way to draw from the same creative well. And this turned out to be it.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about the sort of crushing disappointment that that made you say, I'm done with the music. I'm done making music.
Sure. Except that you used the singular. And there are many crushes.
Yeah. I mean, I remember a particular event that I was thinking about, but you've got...
Yeah. No, I've been on three different major labels. It was not a good experience, and primarily because I realized that I love making music and I really love recording it, but I'm not good at the business side part of it. So I don't have the temperament for it. To thrive in that world, and that became pretty apparent pretty fast. Mm-hmm. And the major label stuff was very disappointing, and I didn't know how to navigate it. And I never made worse music than when I was on a major label, unfortunately. And but the way I ended up getting dropped from a major label had more to do with like inner office politics than it did with me. You belong to kind of the person who signs you. And if that person who signs you gets crossways with like the president or there's some political issue there, sometimes those records get killed, not because they don't believe in the record, but because it's just petty politics in the office. And that was that's the case in my case. However, it's not like I was primed for superstardom or anything like that, because I had my own struggles, but I wasn't the only one who went through that. There were other guys and other artists who definitely had the radar for navigating that world better than I did. And they suffered the same thing because they had been hired, they had been signed by the same person. So that was like crushing blow number one. I ended up in this band called Swag with a bunch of friends who happened to be in more successful bands like Sixpence None the Richer and the Mavericks and Cheap Trick. And then there ended up being conflict in that band over exactly who was in Swag, because Cheap Trick was having a resurgence at the same time. And so we'd already had a record out. And we had to address this who's actually in the band thing after the record came out. And that made everybody mad at each other. And once again, I don't navigate that world really well. So then that record was starting to kind of take off, and all of a sudden inner band politics kind of blew it up, unfortunately. And it was unfortunate because I like all of those guys, and we've all gotten back together and we're friends, but it just didn't work out. But it was another big disappointment. And so I swore I was never going to be in a band again. I was just going to make my little indie records, have my day job, hanging out with you down there at Cummins Station. And I got this email one day from the guitar player of the Cars, who said he wanted to talk to me about something. And it turns out he had heard me do a cover of one of their songs, and they were and he liked it, and which was reward enough for me, because I love the Cars. I loved them as a kid, and I always loved their guitar player. I would actually think when I was making my own songs a lot of times, if I got to a solo, what would that guy do, and I'd try to like play like something as creative as he would. Always fail because he's just so great. But he was like that, what I was shooting for. And he's the guy who called me, and he said that they were putting the band back together, and that Rick, the main songwriter or the songwriter, and one of their lead singers didn't want a tour. The other songwriter or the other singer had died a couple of years earlier of cancer. And so they needed somebody who could both write that way and sing like both guys. And he thought I could do it. It was like, the rock and roll fairy godmother had dropped out of the sky and said, "And you shall be the singer of the Cars." And he wasn't even
You're really making out. Interactive training for fetal heart monitoring. And here comes.
I know, it was totally bizarre. I got home, told my family, and they thought I was pranking them, that I'd had this like completely surreal, bizarre conversation. And I, of course, I told him yes, that would be amazing. So I even started writing songs for it. And before anything could really happen, there was a time period where they were like settling all the legal stuff with the guy who didn't want to go out on the road because it's all his songs. And, he's a part owner of the band and all of that. Mm-hmm. And while they were doing that, there was a shift in what they wanted to do, because initially they were thinking, it's like Journey. They went on that, got that guy from the Philippines, and it's just as great as it ever was. And, they just picked up right where they left off without Steve Perry. And that was kind of the vision. Mm-hmm. And that's where I came in, because I would be like the nobody who fills the slot. Mm-hmm. But as they got things sorted out, it shifted focus to trying to get a name brand in there as the singer, somebody who was well known. And they ended up getting a guy who'd been a mentor to me as the singer, a guy named Todd Rundgren. And it was Todd who told me he had been offered the gig. And, you know, there was not a lot of communication about me, all about this whole kind of change in focus. So I learned it from the guy who got my gig. But, you know, he's never in the cars ever in the first place. So it's theirs to choose whoever they want. And, but it was really hard. And that was where I was like, okay, I finally didn't try to engineer this thing at, you know, my career or whatever. And I had this completely out of the blue invitation to join like one of my favorite bands as a kid. And I mean, that's just that's a door opening right there. And so I chose to walk through it, and it just slammed right in my face. And I couldn't really make sense of why that was for a while. And it's only in hindsight that I look back at it and see that I had made an idol of my identity as a professional musician, as opposed to my identity being in Christ. And I was relying on all the wrong things for my assurance. I can't really think of a better way to have that idol exposed and rooted out, but man, it was painful at the time. You know, it did a lot of psychological damage. You know, I couldn't even listen to music for a long time, got rid of most of my gear. My son, who's a professional musician now, was in the middle of learning guitar. I couldn't teach him. I couldn't do it because I just felt was so embittered most of the time. Yeah. Anytime I did listen to music, it had to be completely different than anything I had ever been a part of before. It had to be music I didn't understand, because there were too many things where, you know, I'd put it on, I go, oh yeah, I remember, you know, meeting them or, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I remember that period and you saying, you know, something like, don't plan on ever playing music again. And I didn't believe you, you know. I mean, I was like, I couldn't imagine you not doing it. But
I didn't.
Kind of stuck to it until recently when Alan Parsons, you connected with Alan Parsons.
It wasn't kind of a reconnect because I actually didn't know Alan Parsons, but it wasn't at the same time. It also was not a fairy godmother situation like the Cars. So, but Alan Parsons is an artist whom I've admired since I was a kid. Always thought was like super mysterious and intellectual, and made these really incredible concept records that were a lot different than any of the power pop stuff that I did. And about 3 or 4 years ago, my old bass player, who plays for Alan Parsons now, plays saxophone and sings about half the songs live, sent me a text and he goes, "Hey man, you just got a cut on Alan's new record." I was like, "What are you even talking about?" Yeah. And Alan Parsons was making his first record in like 15 years and needed songs because the guy that he wrote songs with had passed away a few years earlier, and they had stopped working together even before that. And he needed songs. And my friend played him a song that we had written together back like before you and I knew each other. And Alan was like, "Great," and cut it that day, which was completely bizarre. Yeah. And then he said, "Well, you know, Alan has themes on all his records, and he's an amateur magician." And my friend was like, "You're an amateur magician. We should write songs about magic." And I was like, "Man,
nerdy."
It was so nerdy. And I said, "I don't do that anymore. You know, that's super nice, but I can't do it. You're in that world. I'm just going to leave it to you." And he just didn't believe me that part of me was gone. That it could be gone. And so he kind of kept after me, and he finally came over one day, and he had an idea for a verse of a song. and he had a tiny little, you know, iPhone demo of it. And it was, you know, a simple melody and a couple of chords that were very simple, but there was something kind of charming about it. And so we worked on it for about an hour. And then the longer we worked at it, the more I could see in his eyes, this, he could see that I wasn't lying. I don't do this anymore. I don't have this. This is not going well. And when you're in a co-writing situation and you know it's not going well, it's really hard to end it. But it wasn't going well. And finally, he was like, I'll just leave it with you for a while. And so you tell me if anything happens. And I said, well, let's run through it one more time. And so we played it. And we played something. All of a sudden, we played a complete song. We never wrote it. We just discovered it. The chorus was just there accidentally. Mm. It never was developed. It came out fully formed as a piece of music. And we were both looking at each other like, what the heck just happened? You know, yeah. we were recording it. So we had it down. And so we were able to just refine it a little bit, but it didn't need hardly anything. And then I wrote words to it the next day. And then we recorded a demo and Alan liked it and he cut that one too. And and he was very gracious in allowing me to come out and sing background vocals on it. Mm-hmm. And which was amazing.
I got a question for you about all this. Okay. The last time you had this sort of surprise opportunity to work with one of your favorites, you realized, you know, I doubt that there was some serious idolatry going on. I mean, after the door got slammed in your face, then you were able to see that as idolatry. How is it different this time around, besides the fact that you're 20 something years older? I mean, maybe that's the main thing. You're older, you're more mature, you know a little more about who you are and your identity and where it comes from. But can you talk to me about that, how this is different?
Yeah, it's not an age difference, although there could be a factor in it, but it's a spiritual maturity difference. Mm-hmm. And the fact that I am not hanging anything on this, I am an art director at a homeschool publishing company that makes science textbooks, okay? So the chance to go out to Santa Barbara for a few days and sing on an Alan Parsons record, that's like me like going into the phone booth and coming out as Superman. I fly off for a few minutes and do something. Then I come back and I am Clark Kent. And I'm like Clark Kent 99.9% of the time. And what made it, what was different is knowing that, well, two things. The only way I was able to write the music is because it was a write for assignment thing. Mm. I don't think about music. I don't listen to music. I don't write music. But I was given an assignment. Mm. We're going to write a magic song that sounds like it goes on an Alan Parsons record. Well, that sounds fun. Okay, I'm so limited. What I could do there, that sounds like a cool challenge. So. Yeah. So that's what happened. And then it was over. I knew it had an expiration date. Okay. I'm going to write this thing. Then it's done. Then I'm not going to try to engineer any relationship with Alan Parsons. He doesn't know who I am, doesn't care who I am, because he's got like 8,000 people a day vying for his attention. And I hate that business. I don't want to be a part of that business. I love recording. And to record with like one of the all-time legends. I mean, he had just been, I mean, right after I did that, he received the OBE. So he received the Order of the British Empire. And I mean, he's like, he's that influential, that legendary. Of course I'm going to do that. So the only thing I really had to get over psychologically, knowing that this was like a one-shot thing and I'm in and I'm out and I don't have to fool with the business. That's what made it tolerable, because I knew who I was. My identity was secure. I didn't care if Alan Parsons liked me or ignored me or whatever. I was going to get to go in there and sing on one of his records. But I got behind the mic and you know, I'm looking at him through the control room window and my first thought is, okay, so I don't do this anymore, right? I'm an art director. this is the perspective. This is what Paul McCartney looked at when he sang My Love or Oh Darling. Or, you know, this is what Roger Waters and David Gilmour were looking at when they recorded Money. You know, it was really surreal. So, but he sat there with such a blank expression on his face that it wasn't that intimidating. It was just, so I did what I did and he liked it. And he asked if I would sing on more things in the future. And I was like, of course, absolutely. But you know, that my wife is afraid I was going to run off with the circus again, and this was going to be a problem. And I was like, not going to happen. He was a very nice man, but I mean, I'd leave the room and he'd forget my name pretty much, basically. And not because he's a jerk, but just because he's got so many people. And that's the way that world is. Everybody wants something from the guys who have made it. And I think he appreciated the fact that I didn't treat him that way. So that turned into this spring when he made his new record that just came out 2 weeks ago, and I had two more songs on that, and I was able to still sing on those and be a part of those.
One of those songs being about the snake, the symbol of the snake eating its own tail, Ouroboros, is that
how you say it? Ouroboros, yes. And which is actually on the cover of an old Alan Parsons record, but he never uses the word. So I use the word Ouroboros, and then he invited the singer for Styx to sing it, Tommy Shaw, and that became the lead single off the record.
You're not running off with the circus this time, huh?
I'm not running off with the circus, but it was me and the co-writer of the song, Todd Cooper, down at this studio in Nashville with Tommy Shaw singing the vocal, and Alan, it was funny, Alan goes, after Tommy finished his vocal, Tommy's standing there and Alan goes, so how does the song end? And I said, well, we got this round of like repeating voices and stuff. And I said, you know, I could send you the demo again if you need to hear it. He goes, why don't you just go in there and sing it? So all of a sudden, I'm right back in that spot. I hadn't planned on doing it. Yeah. But so that's what's on the record.
No, I love this idea of you doing the work and getting to enjoy that and do work you're proud of without feeling like you need to run off with the circus.
It is freeing.
I'm really glad
very
for
much. Cause I used to get in there and like have everything writing on everything I did. And it constricted the creativity and I was so beholden to all the, like the record company people and all of that. Yeah. They my first record reflects them more than it does me because I let them make those choices. Now I don't have to let them.
Yeah. So I did a series of episodes on this podcast called Sad Stories Told for Laughs, in which, you know, people would largely performing musicians or performers would come and talk about, you know, terrible things that happened that now seem funny. And, you know, you're just sort of telling sad stories, not even told for laughs, you know, this would fit in with that series, except that it's not so funny.
Well, on my bad days, they'd come off more sad and more bitter for sure. So, but, you know, I listen to the Cars and every time they come on, I sing along, but you know, it took me a while to get there.
Yeah.
Honestly.
I'm glad you can sing along with the Cars now.
Yeah.
Because I was, you know, for a while there, I tried to be mad at the Cars on your behalf and I just couldn't because I love them so much.
I know. I'm with you.
Hey, we need to wrap this thing up. So tell me, who are some writers who make you want to write?
The one that has most impacted me recently is Arturo Perez Reverte. I went through almost all of his books last year.
I don't know that writer. Tell me about him.
He's a Spanish writer, and I read his second book in the early 90s when it came out. It's called The Club Dumas, and I thought it was one of the most clever books I've ever written. He's very much, there's a lot of similarities between him and Zafon, Ruiz Zafon, uh-huh. and in the sense that the beauty with which he writes and kind of that almost magicalness in the atmosphere that he creates actually comes through in the English translations. The beauty of that must be in that original language, because I don't read Spanish.
Yeah.
It's so present in the English translation. It's just beautiful writing. But the stories are great too. Yeah. And he writes in such a variety of ways. He's a former newspaper journalist who was a war correspondent. So he has he's got a he's got a very strong grasp of history and has a bunch of different genres that he writes within. They're all fascinating. There's some great mysteries. There are some kind of pastiches to Alexander Dumas in there that he does. But I love Caleb Carr, who wrote the Alienist, which I think is an absolutely fascinating book. Because it's both the history of New York City primarily and all the stuff that goes along with it, and a great story at the same time. So, with my books, I try to write a book that I wish I would have read.
Yeah.
And what I love to do is learn about things with the spoonful of sugar of fiction. And so my books have archaeology and history and some apologetics, and it's all wrapped up into one thing for people who don't really like reading nonfiction but want that information.
Yeah. Oh, great. Well, Doug, thank you so much for being here. Look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. Hopefully it won't be quite as long before next time.
The Habit Podcast is brought to you by The Rabbit Room, where art nourishes community and community nourishes art. To check out more of our podcasts, visit rabbitroom.com/podcast. Our work at The Rabbit Room would be impossible without the generous support of our membership. If you'd like to learn more about membership at The Rabbit Room, visit rabbitroom.com/member. And thanks for listening.
The Habit Membership is a library of resources for writers by me, Jonathan Rogers. More importantly, The Habit is a hub of community where like-minded writers gather to discuss their work and give each other a little more courage. Find out more at thehabit.co.